Good morning and welcome to Talking About California. Here we continue our series of discussions with Californians who talk about this place, their home, and their work here. I'm Cal Winslow. I'm your host. I'm the director of the Mendocino Institute. I'm also a research fellow at the University of California, Berkeley. This morning we will be talking again with Summer Brenner. Breaking a bit from precedent, we talked with Summer last fall, but in a fascinating discussion that ran out of time, and many callers noted this with some disappointment. So I've asked Summer to come back. Summer Brenner is a Bay Area writer and activist. She's the author of two thrillers, dark novels, Nearly Nowhere and I-5. Also, a collection of stories, My Life in Clothes. She's now working on a novel, Leaving the Atlantic. When we ran out of time, we were talking with her about her book, Richmond Tales, a wonderful story for young people. I found it very interesting to look at the back cover of the book and see the praise there, as is so common with paperback books, but to see the praise there mainly coming from young people, probably teenagers. So let's go back there, if you don't mind, Summer, to Richmond Tales and talk a bit about that. And then there'll be lots of time to follow up. So what's the status of Richmond Tales and what exactly is it again?
Oh, yes. Thank you, Cal, for inviting me back on the show. It's my pleasure and honor. Well, Richmond Tales really came out of literacy projects I was already doing in Richmond, California. And I had been getting grants starting around 2002 to conduct workshops around poetry writing or reading with at-risk teenagers in Richmond. And I'm also on the board of an organization of literacy and library advocates called West County Reads. And we were charged by the superintendent of schools to figure out a way to get siblings to read together, families to read together for that matter, but even older children in a family to read to younger ones. And having heard about the national library program called One City, One Book, I suggested to our board that we look for a children's book that we could distribute to many, many children in Richmond and try to ignite a community conversation around reading. So that's the genesis of Richmond Tales, Lost Secrets of the Iron Triangle. But when a children's librarian and I couldn't really come up with a book that would be appropriate or relevant enough to the diverse population of Richmond, someone obviously suggested that I write the book. I mean, it was really sort of like a Satori moment. Oh, yes, I could do that. So raising the funds to do that, I wrote a book for young teens, and it's a time travel adventure story where two kids who live in the Iron Triangle, which is one of the poorest and most dangerous communities of Richmond, time travel back into Richmond history. And Cal, you've read the book. They go back to an Ohlone village. They go back to the early part of the 20th century when Richmond is a small but burgeoning industrial city. It's where Sinclair Oil plants its footprint, and it's, of course, remained there all more than 100 years. Now we know it is Chevron. And then into World War II when the population of Richmond quintuples. And when I was writing the book, I only thought about the past, connecting kids who live in a place that, as they say, they want to leave as soon as possible. They want to survive the streets to grow up and depart. But they have no relationship to the history of the place. And because the history is lost, their own perception is lost that what was once could come again. The transformation is always what's occurring in a place that you live. But if you have no connection to the history of it, you don't feel like you're a part of the history or a part of that continuum. What I didn't know when I was writing the book, as it was unfolding, was that I needed to include the future. And in fact, the future has been one of the most important aspects of the book. So the kids time travel back, but then they also go into a future that models a way that they have transformed the place that they live. And not only that, they fulfilled their own very grand ambitions to make a mark. The book is hopeful. It doesn't sanitize the present conditions of living in Richmond. There's a drive-by shooting, and in fact, a teenager is killed in the book. So that's a reflection of the reality that a lot of young people live with. And as a result, the book has been wildly, wildly popular. I may have mentioned in the last conversation we had that we were able to print and give away over 4,000 free copies of the book.
Summer, tell us how to get a hold of the book then at this.
Well, the book was really written and designed to be distributed almost exclusively to the families and young population of Richmond. But there are books available for sale at the new Homefront Museum, which is really worth a visit the next time your listeners might be in the Bay Area, which is the homage to the workers at the Kaiser Shipyards, but the workers all over the United States who put so much of their effort, skill, and even great loss of life into providing the ships and the munitions and the all the material that went into the war. It's for sale at the Museum of History in Richmond, and it is for sale online at Amazon. So interested parties can get a copy of it.
And what's happening with it now? How is it being used now?
Well, it's still being distributed to schools. Libraries have programs around it. And just one of the most surprising outcomes of doing the book is twofold. April 20th is going to be the fourth annual grassroots-generated Richmond Tales Family Festival. It's partly supported by the city. It's partly supported by Kaiser Permanente and other nonprofit groups that participate in this fair, where books and educational games and literacy, both for workshops for parents around reading to children and various educational motivations that parents can tap into resources, and also just health literacy as well. So those are the kind of the themes of the fair. There's always a Native American ceremony that opens the festival, and there's lots of entertainment. I encourage anyone who's interested to come. And then the second remarkable thing that's come out of the book is a play that's going to be produced by the East Bay Center for Performing Arts. I've written a theatrical adaptation of the book. It will be called Lost Secrets of the Iron Triangle. And I'm working with the dramaturg Ellen Sebastian Chang, and she's helping me animate these characters for a stage production. I said to her, they animate in my head when I write, but when I have to transpose them to stage, it's challenging. I've really learned a lot. And the play is opening May 16th. There's been a great contribution financially from the Richmond Rotary. And I think it's going to be a fantastic production. So, again, if your listeners, if you're around the Bay Area, the weekend of mid-May, and then I believe the following weekend, the play will be running at the East Bay Center for Performing Arts, which is a beautiful, renovated, 1916, perhaps, building. I'm not sure of the exact date there, but beautiful renovated building. That's a tremendous center that teaches drama, dance, and music to mostly the young people of Richmond. So that's
great news. Yeah, and congratulations
Thank you,
Summer Brenner. Let me just say now you're moving on with a similar project about Oakland. Is that right?
Yes. I call Richmond the blueprint, and now I'm sort of constructing a much bigger building. Oakland is daunting. I'm writing it. I'm way into the writing process. I'm almost complete with the research process. I'm picking up some loose ends over the next few weeks of people I've meant to speak to in these many last months of the research phase. Places I've meant to visit but haven't gotten around to. So I have a list, and I have still a couple of books to read, although I've read many, many books about Oakland history and some fiction as well. It's been fascinating.
So,
but as I say, it's daunting. Oakland is four times the population of Richmond. The neighborhoods, the geographical breadth of it is... You know, anyone who's traveled from on the highways to the Oakland airport or to the port or to the BART stations, it's a very big geographical area. And because I want it to be as inclusive as possible, and because I want it to touch the young people who are maybe the least inclined to read and, in fact, maybe struggling with English and have challenges around language and literacy, I've had to explore some areas of Oakland where, you know, I've never been, what they call Deep East. So beyond Fruitvale, which you may be familiar with, there's this stretch of blocks and blocks and blocks of Oakland that go from East Oakland into Deep East. And it's where many of the housing projects are, where, you know, there's many of the challenges that Oakland faces around poverty and violence. West Oakland might be a more familiar place by the port, and there was a train station, that beautiful old train station that functioned on 16th Street, practically on the water, until, you know, fairly recently. Anyway, I'm very engaged with the Oakland book, and we hope to have a book available again for the distribution through Oakland Unified School District by late next summer.
How about just a taste of the historical themes or points that you've found in your look at Oakland?
Well, for the fictional characters, I'm taking one of the characters from Richmond and having her, Maisha is her name, Maisha Yates. She's one of the main characters in the Richmond book. And Jada Yates in West Oakland is going to be one of the main characters. So I'm trying to do a cross-pollination here so that kids who read either or might be interested in the other. And also, it emphasizes the very strong and very deep connections between Oakland and Richmond. I mean, many families move back and forth between the two, and going back into history, Kaiser brought an antiquated L train that he then installed that went from Oakland through Berkeley and El Cerrito to the Kaiser shipyards in Richmond.
Kaiser, just tell us, our listeners, in case they don't know Kaiser.
Oh, yes, the Kaiser shipyards. There were four shipyards. There were also shipyards in Oakland. I mean, they were very active as well. But Kaiser shipyards really dominated the war effort in terms of shipbuilding the Liberty ships and the Victory lines, and they were tremendously productive and innovative. If you imagine old-fashioned shipbuilding, you think of it as being down at the water, and that there are these tremendously skilled artisans and craftspeople who are putting together ships, and then they're launched. But what Kaiser did...
And Henry Kaiser, you mean.
Henry Kaiser, yes, thank you. But Kaiser Permanente, the whole health maintenance organization, evolves from the shipyards themselves. I mean, that's the first HMO in the country, and I'll just mention a little bit about that when I finish describing this fabrication innovation. So that he had these great metal shops that were on site of the shipyards in Richmond, where pieces of the ship would be fabricated, and then all you had to do, and I don't say that lightly because it was a tremendous job, but then you just had to weld and rivet these pieces of ships together like a model. And thus we have Rosie the Riveter and Wendy the Welder, as the men increasingly went off to fight the war, and the women and, of course, people of color were brought in to work on the ships and to assemble them. That's what it became. It became more of a challenge of assembling than actually building. And each worker, and the shipyards ran, the four shipyards in Richmond ran 24/7. Each worker paid a modest amount of money. I mean, it might have been, I used to know exactly, but 50 cents a week or something, maybe even less, to have full medical coverage. And there were triage stations that were right near the ships themselves, and then a center for treatment that was nearby, wounds that were less grievous, and then a center in Oakland where ambulances could take people who were very badly hurt. And in fact, as I mentioned earlier, people not only got badly hurt, but died in these war efforts. There's a great Ford plant in, I keep going back to Richmond instead of Oakland, but there's this enormous glass plant on the water, very beautiful. It's been renovated. It was the Ford plant, and during the war that was converted to making Jeeps and tanks. And no Jeep or tank went out of that plant without reading material. So every soldier who got in to those vehicles would find newspapers and magazines and news from home.
So, and it's in these years that the population of the East Bay, especially Oakland, is transformed. Is that right?
Yes, a tremendous influx of people out of the Depression coming into the Bay Area to work in the war industries. But what we particularly note is this enormous population explosion of African Americans. We come back to segregated housing for the workers, as well as military personnel. But in Richmond, there's several curiosities around the war. The movie theaters, of which there were maybe a dozen in downtown Richmond, were open 24/7 as well because there were no beds in town, and workers came into the movie theaters to sleep. That's highlighted in my Richmond Tales book. With Oakland, housing was, of course, also a tremendous shortage, and people were living in chicken coops and garages and, any place that they could rest their head. But you do have Hunters Point, Oakland, and Richmond as these centers where African Americans gravitated because that's where they found work, and with the work, they found dignity. There was tremendous hopefulness coming up from the South and a lot of sort of feisty spirit about the kind of freedoms they were going to find in California. And some of that was disappointment. I mean, they would go for work and they couldn't join the unions. They were given menial tasks, such as sweeping up the same kind of work they might have found in the Jim Crow South. So they found discrimination. And also, there was a small African-American population that was already settled since the 19th century, since the mid-19th century in the Bay Area, and they had made their way slowly but surely into a kind of working class or even middle class, and all of these newcomers with their, blues music and their taste and maybe food and their barbecue joints and their juke joints and even the way they spoke, it was a kind of unsettling moment for the African-American populations that were, were many generations into living here. And let me just take a moment to talk about something that will appear in the Oakland book, is that with the gold rush, you have many Southerners coming to California, and of course California becomes a battleground over whether it's going to be slave or free if it comes into statehood. But with those Southerners came their slaves, and because of the gold rush, working in the mines, working in the shanty towns that sprang up around the mines, the African Americans were often able to buy their freedom from their masters, and they were able to prospect on their own on occasion. They were able to cook and do laundry. I mean, the Chinese also filled those menial tasks, but there's many instances where a black population of slaves not only could buy their freedom, but made enough money where they could buy their family's freedom and bring them to California. So those are the first black settlers in the Bay Area.
So where can we watch for Oakland Tales to be available sometime? Do you have
I do have a timetable. We're hoping to have the book out by next summer. I mean, this summer. So 2013. By the way, I have to just attribute part of the success and the magnet that the book became in Richmond to Miguel Perez's cover and illustrations. He's a hip-hop artist, and he did this fantastic cover with a kind of graffiti style font. The kids looked at that. They said, "This is cool. This is a cool book to read," and boys as well as girls. And we're going to also replicate that model in Oakland so that the cover will suggest something about how this is a book that reflects the youth. This is going to be partly their story in the present, and then partly their journey into the past. Their story is going to be a bit grittier. I mentioned Jada, our West Oakland girl. She finds out her father, who she's been told all her life is in the military, is actually in prison. And Ernesto, who is our young man from Deep East, he's just gotten out of the youth authority, and he's trying to turn his life around from gangs. And so those are the main characters, and they'll be going back to a village, an Ohlone village, which the Hutchins was the group of Native Americans that actually lived along the bay in what we call Oakland now. And they'll be visiting them. They'll be also going into the California era. I touch on that in Richmond, but it's a very important part of Oakland history because the Peraltas in the late 1700s, the senior Peralta was given a land grant by the King of Spain that was over 40,000 acres and stretched from what we call San Leandro to El Cerrito. He had four sons, four daughters as well, but his four sons inherited this land, and the Peralta family house is still intact, and it's a tremendously rich place to visit. It's a museum. It's a great archive. I've been there many times working in the archives. There's a beautiful garden with native plants, and the spirit of the Peralta House, the Peralta Museum, which is in the Fruitvale District, it invites all the various communities around it to participate so that there's many Southeast Asians that have a garden there. There are exhibits there that reflect the neighborhood. It's, and as I said, it's a wonderful little museum to see how the Californios lived in the 19th century. This was not their original home, which would have been adobe, but there are actually are remnants of adobe walls, and you can see in a different location because it was moved at one point, part of a Peralta adobe house. The Peralta house that is intact is, I believe, from the 1870s. And the Californios who had lived under Spain and then became part of Mexico when Mexico first won its independence in 1820, and by the way, abolish slavery so that you have an underground railroad. We always think of the Underground Railroad and the heroes of the Underground Railroad as coming north up the Mississippi or through Ohio or into New England. But there was a prominent Underground Railroad that went south into Mexico. And that's a kind of unknown history, or, you know, uncommon, not commonly known. And so when you look at some of the photographs or early portraits from the 19th century, you see Mexican, but now it's Alta California or Californio, portraits of men who look as much African as they do Latin or European. So that's really interesting to note. I mean, Africans also they were imported as labor into Mexico proper as well. But there were these runaway slaves.
Oh, Summer, we're really looking forward then to to seeing this. And listeners, it's going to be Oakland Tales coming out in the summer. This is KZYX. Our program today is talking about California. I'm your host, Cal Winslow. Our guest today is the Bay Area writer, Summer Brenner, the author of, we've been talking about Richmond Tales and Oakland Tales, but also of a new crime book, Nearly Nowhere, from PM Press, and an earlier dark novel, I-5. Summer, I wonder if we could switch gears here, but not really that much. You've talked a bit, quite a bit, really. You've mentioned the South wish we're going to run out of time again. This is so interesting. But you talked a bit about the South. Now, you're from the South.
Yes, I am.
And last time you talked a little bit about coming out of the South, if I remember right, at your parents' insistence. I wondered if we could go back to that subject as an introduction to your work now, which is, I understand, is a new novel, which I think you're going to call Leaving the Atlantic. Is that something we can do here?
Certainly. Yeah, I was raised in Atlanta, Georgia. I was directed to leave the South for college. There was this notion, and somewhat false notion, really, that to get a proper education, you had to leave the South. I went back to the South, and I lived a very different life than the one I had grown up in, as a part of the political upheaval, the New Left, SDS, and the hippies that were coming from every southern town to Atlanta. Atlanta became a mecca for anyone who was seeking adventure and was a bit unusual. I mean, the South is filled, really, and southern literature is filled with eccentric people. But I should say, rather than unusual, rebellious. And so there's a big park in the center of Atlanta called Piedmont Park, and that became the place where free concerts would happen. And there was a whole alternative world, alternative to what I'd known as a child that grew up and that I participated in. There was a wonderful underground newspaper called The Great Speckled Bird.
So we're talking about the 60s here, I guess.
Late 60s, early 70s. By the late 60s, I had actually moved to the West. My first stop for several years was in New Mexico. And then I came to California in 1973.
And so?
Yeah, so I've explored some of these Southern stories in the short story collection you mentioned called My Life in Clothes. But I have a trove of these stories, stories that either happened in my own family and extended family, but all the stories that one accumulates and acquires through one's life. And so the novel that I've been working on for several years is it's a big novel, and I say that because of word count and length. And it's not that it makes it a better novel, although I'm quite proud of it, if I can say that modestly. But it's a little bit like, you know, you run sprints and then you decide to try a marathon. I mean, it's very hard to sustain the stamina to write many hundreds of pages than a couple of hundred pages. And I've been working on it. It started, actually, the book started as a very long story called Leaving the Atlantic, about a 60 or 70 page story. And it evolved from that story into a novel that has six chapters. And it's about family secrets. I think almost everyone can relate to that. And the book begins with the suicide of the father of a girl who will figure as the main character. And the suicide itself is a secret. The father's life is a secret. The Jewish immigrant grandparents, they have secrets. And the secrets are against the canvas of civil rights. So it's a broad, deep subject. And because of the deep divide between black and white in the South that's so visceral, you know, it's part of my genetic code. I was able, I hope, to tap into a kind of emotional resonance of what it was like to grow up there and have one's soul darkened by that experience. And then what it meant to leave the Atlantic, what it meant to cross the Atlantic. I mean, my grandparents, as well as the millions of slaves, the kind of social propriety and the myth of a place in the West where some of those trappings, of course, the word trap is very key to knowing what trappings means. Those trappings could be shed. And I may have said this in the last conversation we had, but I think that life is either running to or from a memory. And so the trappings never go away. We are, you know, we carry them with us. We carry them with us. They're our backpack. But how we reframe them or rearrange them in a new place is something that we could determine on our own. And I was part of a generation that fled the expectations of their families and was seeking transformation of the world and still seeking. I think they're you know, we're older and we align ourselves with the youth who are doing the great work that they're doing. So the Atlantic is, leaving the Atlantic has a very palpable significance to me.
Summer, you said, I think, just back a bit, one soul darkened. Maybe you could explain what you meant by that and give us an idea of just, you know, in one case or whatever, what happened to the young people in that generation, the people, I guess, you're placing yourself with?
Well, I think it happens to anyone who grew up in the South. And even though I think much has changed, to go and visit my 93-year-old aunt in Batesburg, South Carolina, I mean, there's just this, there's a shadow of the, you know, of the Confederacy. And there are a lot of people riding around with Confederate flags on trucks. And you see the vestiges and the evidence of the Confederacy and all of that in bodies. We see it in our government and the, you know, this shadow or darkening over the soul. I mean, Du Bois describes it so beautifully in his work going back over 100 years, where, you know, it's not only the black people who are oppressed by these divisions and divides, it's the white people. It's, you know, I mean, so that's the kind of darkening I'm talking about, and it goes on generation after generation. In my own life in particular, I can just remember, and again, I hope I'm not repeating myself.
No, not at all.
A story that I might have mentioned in the first round. My grandfather, an immigrant from Lithuania, and who began his life as a peddler with a mule and a wagon in the Georgia countryside, the Jew man who took the pots and pans and needles and threads and all the kind of notions that country people needed and didn't have a store to go to buy. And he became eventually a very wealthy man. He had a flour and feed mill in downtown Atlanta. You'd have to drive over dirt streets to get to it. Clay, really. Clay Moore describes what the streets were made of, that famous, infamous Georgia red clay. And you'd pass through these shanty towns. The one in particular that was near his mill was called Buttermilk Bottom. And you'd smell the smell from the slaughterhouse. I mean, it was just sickening. And I, in my mother's, you know, beautiful car, I found myself as a little girl hiding on the floor of the car. And my mother thought there was something, you know, wrong with me. And there was, I didn't want those black children to see me with everything I had and them with nothing. And that was the consciousness of a four-year-old. Put that alongside the atomic bomb, and you have a tremendous darkening. So I won't belabor that, because I do think I touched on some of that in our first conversation. But leaving the Atlantic, crossing the Mississippi, going over those mountains, through those deserts, as I mentioned, I lived in New Mexico for several years, and then coming to the Pacific, an ocean that touches on an entirely different world, a history that's also plagued, but it was a tremendous freedom. And once I got to the West, I never thought of going back.
This is KZYX. My name is Cal Winslow. Our program today is talking about California, and we're very lucky to have the Bay Area writer Summer Brenner with us today. Summer is the author of many books, including Nearly Nowhere, her latest, and I-5, both by PM Press. We've been talking about her forthcoming novel, Leaving the Atlantic.
Well, forthcoming, I'm still, in search of a publisher, but hopefully forthcoming.
I'm sure you'll find one.
Well, thank you,
Summer. Would you like to tell us a bit about your new book?
Yes, I would, Summer, because it is such a Western book.
Let's go with that.
Yeah, Nearly Nowhere. I describe it as a book of rural menace. It begins in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains.
Let me to do this. What exactly is a noir, and what an noir novel? Where's that come from? Yeah.
You have to say it with a French accent.
Sure.
So it's the word in French for black, noir. Yeah. And noir writing and noir films comes out of the detective, the world of the detective, and the world of the gothic. So maybe gothic literature starts with Frankenstein and Mary Shelley and Edgar Allan Poe, and then that's the 19th century lineage, and then you come into 20th century lineage with Raymond Chandler and some of the great, maybe early to mid 20th century crime writers. And then noir is a subset of that, where the subject is particularly bleak. Now, I laugh because I have a great deal of fun writing this kind of work. But, yes, it's particularly bleak. There may be a detective. There may not be. In both of these books that I've had published, there is no that's not the format. But noir is its own particular thing, and I think there are various interpretations of that. Some of the best American films have, and French films as well, have been noir in subject matter. And I think what's attractive to someone like me is that you can really talk about social ills. An entire underclass in Demimonde, not just of petty criminals, but people who find themselves in very compromised situations because of class and economics. So in I-5, that's a book about sex trafficking and a Russian girl that's been brought into the United States, and she's being transported on I-5, Interstate 5, from Los Angeles to Oakland. All of this ties in. back to Oakland. The Nearly Nowhere is also something of a road trip, but in this case, the road is a river. And it begins in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains in a village, Zamora, a fictitious village up in those mountains. But I've spent quite a bit of time in the area north of Santa Fe and Española, and then up into Truchas and Taos. So that kind of maps where those mountains are. And then it travels from there to the Bitterroot Wilderness, which is the Salmon River in Idaho. And these places of nowhere, you know, are filled, as someone recently said, with lots of somewheres, because there's a cast of menacing characters. And the book centers around a troubled teenage girl and her relationship with her mother. And so there's a lot of landscape in the book. And I guess going back to our discussion about Richmond Tales, The Atlantic, Oakland Tales, another kid's book I wrote called Ivy, A Homeless in San Francisco, places are very much characters in the work. And I try to bring the place alive to the reader. I mean, it is something I'm very conscious of doing. So New Mexico, as I mentioned, was a place I lived for several years. And the Salmon River was the first place I had the thrill of going on a week-long whitewater river trip. I was terrified, but in the very beginning. I mean, just listening to the sound of the river and knowing that I was going to be going down it on a raft was very frightening, but I was just overcome by the end of the trip with the kind of, I guess, kind of a spiritual affirmation or awakening that occurred by being on a river. And in fact, I will describe that briefly. I felt so small, so insignificant, so egoless, so part of a wave or a leaf or a, you know, just, it just was wonderful. I know you live in a place where there's the natural environment is so accessible to you, and the Bay Area has tremendous opportunity to hike or to be on the water. And I do try to take advantage of it, but not seeing the car for a week. And then later in my very brief river running life, being on a river once for 18 days, not seeing buildings or cars is so significant. It's literally so refreshing. And when I came off that Salmon River trip, I wanted so much to go back to it. And the way I was able to travel back to it initially was to write this book. And I'll mention that it was first published in French in France in the late 90s. It was called Presque Nulle Part. It was translated by a woman named Hérisson, who had worked a lot in the Série Noire, which was is a very famous series. And this book happened to be published in that series, which starts in the 1940s from Gallimard in France, publishing many American detective, crime, and noir writers, as well as other European writers, and kind of creates this phenomenon of noir and detective literature in France. So that book was published then. When PM Press invited me to republish it, I had a chance to work on it, and actually I did quite a bit of rewriting from the French version, I was pleased to revisit it.
So just a hint at the plot.
Well, Ruby is a girl, a teenage girl, whose African-American father was killed in the Gulf War. She's never known her father. And Her white mother is a dropout, a total dropout, and lives pretty much on her own, except for an occasional man that she might meet on an occasional outing in a place down the mountain that she might go to. She's brought a man home who needed a place for a night or two, and he's just stayed on. And he's a pathological liar that we know almost from the beginning of the book. But he turns out to be much more threatening than that. And as a result of his presence, Ruby ends up running away. And so there's a tremendous confusion in the village of whether she's been kidnapped, whether she's involved with drugs, or whether she's stolen a car and left. And her mother is beside herself with worry. And then the plot kind of goes along from there. But when we talk about rural menace, and maybe in particular when we think about some of the things that have gone on in the Northwest and Idaho, there is a kind of not only neo-Nazi faction that is part of the story, but also what's called EK, or the European Kindred, which is a kind of a newer evolution of white, kind of Aryan white supremacy that's evolved on the streets, and which has also infiltrated the prisons. And it rather than centering around Christianity, it centers around Norse mythology. And so there's a kind of a roots identity that's going on. And I try to capture some of that, you know, interesting subculture in the book as well.
Okay, here we are running out of time again. This is, once again, I have to thank you. Some are very interesting. But I did want to ask you about one last thing. Obviously, you're doing so much, but you mentioned to me something called the Al Mutanabe Starts Here project. And so maybe we could finish up with that. What's that project about, and how are you involved in it?
Well, Al Mutanabe Street is the street of booksellers in Baghdad. It's named for a 9th or 10th century poet, Al Mutanabe. And the street has been in existence as a place where readers and writers and seekers of conversation and tea and coffee and books come. And after the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, that street maintained a certain integrity because it was considered a neutral zone. And that was a sort of a tacit understanding of the street, that you could come there, you could look for books. During the earlier era, many books had been banned, and you could find banned books there. And you know, everything from computer manuals to Walt Whitman to Huck Finn translated into Arabic. I mean, you know, just a range of literature from around the world, religious texts and tomes, practical kinds of manuals, and it was just it was a very rich place. Many bookshops and some booksellers with their wares on the streets. That was there was a car bomb that went off in March of 2007, shattered the streets, killed several dozen, injured many, many more. Wiped out some of the most famous landmark places, one of them called the Shandabar Cafe. It was written about in the Washington Post in March 2007, and it was, that article was written by Anthony Shadid. Your listeners might remember that he was the very eminent journalist who died in Syria last year, tragically died in Syria. And he, his piece from the Washington Post begins a new anthology called Al-Mutanabi Street Starts Here. And the project was seeded, but there's a lot to say about this project. It's such a magnificent project. I'll try to hurry. But Beau Beausoleil, who is a poet and bookstore owner in San Francisco, read about this bombing, and he was so shocked that that books and conversation and community gathering of this sort would be attacked, that he started the Al-Mutanabi Street Project. And it is like a seed that has blossomed into an enormous tree, because not only is there this new anthology, Al-Mutanabi Street Starts Here, Poets and Writers Respond to the March 5th, 2007 Bombing of Baghdad Street of the Booksellers. And I will mention that there are many, many writers from the Middle East writing in Arabic who are translated here, some of them translated into English for the first time. And the writing is just tremendous. There are many American writers, myself included. I was a guest editor in the project, along with several other invited editors. And the project also includes 130-something broadsides, the number of the wounded and the dead. And some of these broadsides have been made out of paper that has been made out of military uniforms, where soldiers have boiled and beaten the cloth from their uniforms into paper, and then created broadsides using, in many cases, maybe the poetry that appears in this anthology. Those broadsides are now en route to the National Library in Baghdad and will be part of their permanent collection. There's going to be an exhibit in Cairo. There's a current exhibit up at the Center for the Book in San Francisco as we speak. It's opening in New York at their Center of the Book. There have been many exhibits in England and in on the Europe continent, and they're ongoing. And there's going to be one in Cairo, not only of the broadsides, but of original artist books, all memorializing or commemorating or celebrating or remembering Mutanabi Street, Al-Mutanabi Street.
And San Francisco, tell us, can you tell us about that? What's happening in San Francisco?
There's an exhibition going on at the Center for the Book, which is, I believe they've just moved locations, so people will have to look up their address and their hours. But the exhibit opened in February 1st, and I believe is going to be up for a few months. I just want to make a note here from the original news article by Shadid that in 1258, when the Mongols sacked Baghdad, it was said that the Tigris River ran red one day and black another. The red came from the blood of the nameless victims massacred by ferocious horsemen. The black came from the ink of the countless books from the libraries and universities. So Baghdad was the great center of learning in the Middle Ages, and these collections of books were destroyed and thrown into the river, and the river was black. So that historical fact is actually referenced a few times in some of the writings that you'll find in the Al-Mutanabi Street collection. Again, that's from PM Press. We are indebted to Beau Beausoleil for his concern and his determination to not let this moment go not let this moment be forgotten, and that wherever books and ideas are attacked and freedom of knowledge is attacked, we're all in jeopardy.
Summer, here we are out of time again. I think we'll have to consider having the Summer Browner program. But thanks very much.
I think this has probably exhausted me, at least for a few years, Cal. Thanks. You very, very much.
And thank you for coming back. And listeners, we'll be back again next week. So thanks for tuning in, and good morning.